This is Americana Podcast, the 51st state. At Americana Podcast, we've talked about longevity and identity within roots-based music a couple of times. It has gotten to a point where these two aspects in particular are becoming notable identifiers in what makes Americana music what it is. There is no doubt that pursuing a career in music is not a typically easy one and requires a great deal of sacrifice and effort. And despite living in the age of American Idol, where many people assume it only takes a good voice to make it big, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of artists putting in immeasurable time to share their music with anywhere from a handful of people to hundreds of people. Our guest today is a prime example of tireless effort and work in the music business. BJ Barham, originally of Rockingham, North Carolina, started American Aquarium in 2006. Despite going through a number of members, Barham is stuck with the band through and through, acting as the frontman and primary lyricist throughout its changes. Touring anywhere from 200 to just over 300 dates a year in its earlier years, BJ recognized early on that in order to have a career as a musician, it would take hard work and dedication. Leaving no market untouched and no stone unturned, American Aquarium has traveled all over the world and has gained a deeply loyal fan base. With 7 records to their name and the additional solo record of BJ's, American Aquarium is notable for songs lyrically geared towards the working class, but backed by Tom Petty-esque sound. Describing points of view, life growing up, and the struggling points in the South, American Aquarium's discography almost acts as a musical love letter from one hard worker to another. So join us today as our host, Robert Earl Keane, speaks with BJ Barham of American Aquarium about the evolution of the band, rigorous touring schedules, and what makes Americana music what it is. I'm your producer, Clara Rose, and this is Americana Podcast, the 51st state.
You see, the man left holding the pen controls how every story ends, and truth becomes a martyr for the sake of the song. But now I'm in a good place. I'm walking that straight line. I'm just getting along, righting these wrongs, one day at a time.
Hello, everybody. This is Robert Earl Keane, and we're here at Americana Podcast, the 51st state. Today, we're talking to BJ Barham, the leader of the group American Aquarium. All right. How you doing, BJ?
I'm doing good. Hanging in there.
Happy to be here.
It's good to be here.
Yeah. By the way, we are at Whitewater on the Horseshoe near Canyon Lake in Texas, and down by New Braunfels, Texas. And that's where we are recording from today. So let me start out with some geography a little bit. Carrboro, North Carolina.
Yeah. Okay.
The Cat's Cradle.
Yeah.
I'm
very familiar with that place.
Yeah.
That's an institution in the state of North Carolina.
Right.
That's our Green Hall.
That's your Green Hall.
If you're a big band and you've came through North Carolina and you've played North Carolina, you've played the Cat's Cradle. Mm-hmm.
So have you played the Cat's Cradle?
I've played it a few times.
Right?
Yeah.
And have you seen some acts there at the Cat's Cradle?
That place defined my college years.
Oh, really?
I went to college at NC State University in Raleigh, which is about 20 minutes away. Mm-hmm. And nobody ever really came to Raleigh. They all came to Chapel Hill, uh-huh. Which only furthered the rivalry between NC State and UNC. But I did cross into enemy territory about twice a week usually to go see bands. When I went to college, that's when I fell in love with songwriting. And when I fell in love with songwriting, I became a student. And like any good student, I went to class a couple times a week. And and my class was going to the Cat's Cradle and seeing bands that would later go on to be kind of defining bands of my inspiration.
And did you, when you went to the Cat's Cradle, did you meet anyone there that had still been part of your life as far as in the world of music, or just friends?
Not really. I've stayed friends with a lot of sound guys, lighting guys, because basically anybody from Chapel Hill who's a musician that doesn't want to work a straight job, I think the Cat's Cradle will hire you to take money at the door or sling drinks. And and so I've got a lot of friends and acquaintances who are now tour managers and LDs and front of house on the road. But they got their start at the Cat's Cradle because they were 19-year-old kids that wanted to be sound guys. You know,
it's a clearinghouse for musicians and people who want to be in the music business.
It really is.
Yeah. It was a good time, just a bad decision. We were all wrapped up with the best intentions. You were out of my league, and I was running out of time to string together words that were gonna make you mine. Ain't it funny how it all works out? Ain't it funny how it all works out? Ain't it funny how every now and then the unfortunate kind get lucky sometimes?
All right, so we can move on to, I want to talk about Rockingham.
Okay.
Your breakout solo record.
Yeah.
And I particularly like to focus on the song Rockingham. Did that come from Rockingham County?
Rockingham County, yeah.
Right. And that's where you're from, Reidsville in Rockingham County? Is that how that works?
Reidsville is right in the middle of Rockingham County. It's born and raised there, first 18 years of my life. Looking back, I can see the positive, but those first 18 years, I couldn't see any of the positive. All I saw was the negative. And that record is kind of a, it encapsulates my feelings about that town. It shows some of the positive rays of sunshine that can squeak through a big old wall of negativity sometimes.
Right. I heard that record as truly a dead, solid, perfect Americana classic, that particular song.
Oh, thanks.
There, I thought that... just, you know, the vibe, the sort of the relaxed vocal that you had going on there, and, you know, the, like, really clear but not, like, overly long story. It was, you know. And
for sure.
And it also seems to, you seem to celebrate, you know, the working man's plight, and I think that one just nails it.
Yeah, that record, most of my stuff has been very, very centered in blue-collar America. Just because it's what I grew up in, it's what I know, it's what I feel comfortable writing about. But Rockingham, that record itself, you know, that's through almost 4 years ago, and I'm still super proud of that record. Just it got to show a side of me that for a long time we were just a pretty good bar band that had a songwriter fronting it.
Right.
And I think that gave people on a national level, like, oh, wait, this kid actually writes songs. Mm-hmm. Like, when you tear away the B3 organ and you tear away the loud electric guitars, mm-hmm. there's stories. Mm-hmm. You know, there's three verses and a chorus and three chords, and I'm going to tell you a story about something mm-hmm. that I think is important. Mm-hmm. And I think this is the first record that really allowed me to showcase that.
Mm-hmm. I didn't hear much harmonica on any other records but this record.
No, yeah. I don't think it exists.
Is that right?
Yeah, I'm not really a harmonica player, and I tried the first couple of records. Then I realized, you know, I'm not Dylan, you know, it never will be. And so this record, I was really lucky. I made this record with a bunch of amazing musicians in Durham, North Carolina, and one of the guys was a great harp player, and he threw some stuff down on it, and it sounded great.
And then I read that you started the songs, writing these songs on your European tour that was behind Wolves, right? Is that how that worked?
We were on the European tour of Wolves, and then the Paris attacks happened. We were in Belgium, about 45 minutes from Paris. So our show actually got shut down halfway through the show. And as soon as we got, you know, they came up and said there'd been a terrorist attack in Paris and that we couldn't play anymore. So we didn't know if it was just an isolated incident, if it was going to be multiple music venues around Europe. So they basically put us back in the van, and we went back to Holland, and we got stopped at the border, and we had to stay at a hotel for 3 days while they figured out if it was a full-blown continental thing or if it was just an isolated incident. And in those 3 days, that's where I wrote the record. I wrote that whole record in a hotel room in the middle of nowhere, Holland.
Could you find that hotel room again?
Trust me, I've texted a few tour managers and be like, do you know exactly where we stayed? Because anytime I'm feeling writer's block, I remind myself that, you know, you wrote a record in 3 days, man. Like, you're good. You got months to write a record.
Right.
So, but yeah, it was fruitful. And it was one of those things, I think it was, I wouldn't say it was fear. I wasn't ever afraid for my life. But it was one of those situations where anytime I get uncomfortable, you go to that like warm place. Mm-hmm. And for me, that's home. And instead of calling my mom or going running to my mom, I went there in my head and, mm-hmm. and I wrote these songs about the people and the situations that I grew up in.
So once you got to Holland, you were there for, there were more shows in Holland?
There were. We had that 3 day kind of wait, and then we had the decision of, do we go back home and just call this a wrap, or do we finish the tour? And you know how it is when you go over there, like it's when you're flying a 6-piece band to Europe, that's $1,000 ticket.
Right.
And for a band at our stature at that record, we couldn't afford to eat $6,000.
Right.
So we stayed over there and played another 2 weeks, mm-hmm. and then came back. And I think that was the fall. And then in December, I went in the studio and cut these songs. And we cut them live just with a full band in one room. And that's where the vibe comes from.
Yeah. It's a beautiful record. I really like the whole vibe is great.
Thanks.
Where I was born, where I was raised, on broken promises and glory days. It's the town where I became a man. It's the place that made me who I am. Right there on the river dam, rockin' hand.
If we can back up a little bit to 2015 and the record Wolves, I want to say that the song Wolves has an incredibly lush production to it, and I would say this is what I would call an expensive song. I would say when I hear that kind of thing, I go, "Oh, this song costs some money," but that really means it took a lot of time to put that song together. I mean, I don't know how much. So how long did it take you to record it? And then furthermore, or moreover, how long did it take you to mix that?
It took us, we were in the studio for 8 days to make that whole record.
Uh-huh.
So
you recorded pretty quickly.
We recorded pretty, go into the studio. We're a road band. We're a touring band. And so whenever I have new songs, I just work them up in sound checks. Mm-hmm. We throw them in, you know, they're going to the deep end as soon as they can, you know, no floaties or anything.
Yeah.
And then that's how our songs get their legs, and we can find out which ones are going to be the lusher sounding songs. And right. And Wolves, out of the gate, we knew that was going to be the title track. We knew that was going to be the track that really brought us into a new audience. We're a 6-piece band, and so when you have 6 guys who are as talented as my band was in the studio for that, you know, we sat down, we probably arranged that song for 10-15 minutes, mm-hmm. and then that's just what came out.
Mm-hmm.
And then we got in the studio, and like I said, it probably took us a half a day to record that. Right. Mixing was 2 days.
Was it?
We move quick. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times you get it wrong. But that's a case of us getting it right. We still play that song every single night. I feel like we do a really great job of recreating exactly what we caught in that studio that day, in front of the crowd.
Right. I love all the layers, particularly on that song and in the world of production. I mean, there are things that pop out here. There are things that pop out here.
Oh,
for sure. There are small pieces that seem to, correct me if I'm wrong, but they seem to show up and then they never come back.
Exactly.
It goes like that, right?
There are these one-offs.
Uh-huh.
Like a lot of times in music, there's these recurring themes throughout a song, recurring parts, recurring movements. And in that song, in that whole record, there's a couple songs that just something really cool happens once, and then you sit and wait for it, and it never comes back again.
Yeah.
Sometimes if you find a really cool part, a really cool hook, or a really cool little musical accent, it gets overused. It gets overplayed. And so we found that if you throw it in there like right after that second verse going into the bridge and then never come back to it, mm-hmm. you know, it sticks out even more. It becomes even cooler.
Right. Right. No, it was there some place that you learned that along the way before Wolves that you kind of stumbled on that, or is this something you heard in other records that you went, you know, this is a cool thing?
No, listening back, you can tell that we were listening to a lot of Jackson Browne on those records. That Wolves record in particular reminds me a lot of not any one song in particular, but the vibe that the band was going for in the studio.
Right.
There's multiple moments on that record where I'm like, man, you can tell we were listening to a lot of Jackson Browne in the van.
I just wish someone took the time to warn me about those evil things that lie beyond the trees. When the wolves are hungry, the wolves are lean. I just wish these wolves claws out of me.
Before we talk more about more songs on Wolves, let's go back to the expensive talk about how things take a lot of time. You did a Kickstarter campaign for Wolves.
We've been really big on the crowdfunding. We've never had a label up until things changed. We signed with New West Records, but before that everything was very do-it-yourself, and then we started realizing if we ever wanted to make a record of substance, we needed to get a proper studio, we need to get a proper team, we need to get all that stuff. And then we started realizing, oh wow, that cost a lot of money. and then our first thing was, we started thinking like, man, if I had a nickel for every guy that came up to me at the merch table and was like, man, if there's anything I could ever do to help you guys get ahead, like, let us know. And so we decided to make folks put their money where their mouth was. And it's like, if you love our nobody's buying music anymore. Here we are in 2014 when Wolves came out, you know, if you really love this band, give me $20 9 months in advance, a record you've never heard of, mm-hmm. and help me make this record.
Right.
And we thought, man, it'd be cool if we get like $5,000. Mm-hmm. It'd be cool if we get $10,000 or something like that. And then it just blew up, and our fans like showed up. They literally put their money where their mouth was and was like, okay, here's all the money you could ever need to make a record. Go make your record. So we did it, and we delivered, and I think fans really dug it. And so, of course, next time we're getting ready to do a record, I'm doing Rockingham. Mm-hmm. Same thing.
Yeah.
I ask, hey, this isn't the band. This is me solo. I'm asking for a lot less money. I just want to make this stripped down. Boom. It took 2 days to fund Wolves. It took 3 days to fund Rockingham. Mm-hmm. And things change. Same way, it took about a week. But we also asked for double the money we asked for any of the previous records.
Right.
And it was our fans have just always shown up, and that's the thing about the way we've built our fan base, is it's been very foundational. We don't have a lot of fans, but our fans are never going anywhere. Like those people will come see me when I'm 60, 70 years old, on the way down playing, you know, crawfish boils and chili cook-offs, and you know, it's, you know, when I'm doing that stuff, you know, those fans are still going to be there buying my records every single night since I've started this band all the way up until last week. When I get done playing, I go out to the merch table and I stand there until the last person's done. I shake every single person's hand and tell them how much I appreciate them supporting my music. And it's not just an empty word. It's not just a, you guys have been great. It's a, I'm going to sit here soaking wet in sweat until all of you are gone. I'll take a picture. I'll sign it for your kid. Thank you for letting me not, you know, bartend anymore. Thank you for not letting me wait tables anymore. And our fans have, you know, with Kickstarter and Pledge Music, and they really came through. And so even when we signed with New West, we're like, we don't want to take an advance. We don't want to take your money. Mm-hmm. Like, our fans take care of making our records. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're getting ready to make a record here in August, another record, and I have a feeling that as soon as we put it up, our fans are going to deliver, because they always do. They're great.
Head on now, because there's a certain kind of despair. It hangs heavy in the air. And everywhere I go, I'll always smell the beat.
Fremont Pines. And there's a southern sadness that won't let go of this heart of mine. So I spent the next couple years.
You're listening to BJ Barham, the leader of the band American Aquarium, also bartender, waiter, brave man, and road warrior here. And let me ask you, did you have the songs ready before you started that Kickstarter campaign? I guess you sort of already answered that question as far as like doing these songs and sound checking things. But we on Wolves, you had these things pretty much worked out?
Of the 10 songs on that record, I'd say we had 8 of them already in the can.
Uh-huh.
And a couple of them were just kind of fragmented songs that we went into the studio. And I was like, okay, I got a verse and a chorus. I just need to sit down and focus. I need to write.
Right.
And I'm one of those guys that I have to book studio time to write a record.
Right.
I'm really bad at procrastinating. I've got a 15-month-old at the house and my wife, and when I'm home, it's real easy for me just to like, oh yeah, I'll watch Toy Story 2 again. This is a great movie. And my wife's like, aren't you supposed to be writing songs? I'm like, yeah, I'll get to it. But like, if I book studio time and put money on the line and know that, you know, in 2 months I have to have 10 songs, 11 songs, 12 songs ready, then that's where I get, that's my go time, because I can see this wall coming at me like it's one of those old action movies, and every time I look up, it's getting closer and closer, and I look over and I see the spikes here. I'm like, okay, BJ, like, you got to start figuring out how to get out of this hole.
Well, tell me about the Echo Mountain Studio. We looked it up. It's beautiful.
It's an old church that was built in the 1800s. It sits on the side of the mountains in Asheville, North Carolina, right off the Blue Ridge Parkway. That should sell anybody without even seeing the place.
Right.
But when you walk into it, the A Room, which is where we recorded Wolves, is the old sanctuary. So you're talking about a 300-person Primitive Baptist church on the side of a mountain. So when you walk in, every morning, 8:30, 9 o'clock, whatever call is, natural sunlight's pouring in through these, you know, 120-year-old stained glass windows.
Jeez.
Hardwood floors, just beautifully set up, amps lining the wall, drums in the center. You know, there's probably 8 or 9 tracking rooms, so full baby grand piano. If that doesn't inspire you to make a great record, you know, you're doing it for the wrong reasons. And we had a ball making a record there. I have a rule that I never make a record in the same place. So we travel for every record. We go to a different place.
Mm-hmm.
But I might break my rule one day for Echo Mountain. Yeah. I might start a side project just to go in there.
Well, next time I'm in that area, part of the country, I'm definitely going to check it out. It's really cool.
It's amazing. Yeah. You know, the Averett Brothers, Dawes, Band of Horses, some of my favorite records from the last decade have been made in those rooms.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it's a coincidence. Mm-hmm. I think it's the room adds a lot. It's the sixth man. Mm-hmm. It adds so much just because you might have the songs and you might have the band, but like we talked about earlier, vibe. Vibe is so important on catching music, and vibe is something a lot of people just chalk up to heady talk, you know, oh man, whatever, vibe. Mm-hmm. But if that's the one lesson I've learned in 15 years of doing this, it's vibe is the most important thing. Mm-hmm. You know, the way everybody is if everybody's on that same parallel plane and vibrating at the same time on the right thing, that's when magic happens. Mm-hmm. And I hate to sound spiritual about it when I'm talking, but it's
a spiritual experience.
100%.
Yeah.
And a lot of to lay folk, it's hard to describe that to them,
mm-hmm.
you know, because they look at it as just, you know, it's fingers on a fretboard, it's mm-hmm. piano, it's hitting drums. It's mm-hmm. But when you have 6 individuals who are feeling the same exact thing in the same exact moment in an environment like that, whew, you know, you can keep your Disney World. Like, give me that all day long.
So if you see her out, we'll just tell her I called and that I'm sitting here alone. I'll wait till it falls.
Uh, Back to Wolves. I want to talk about the song Losing Side of 25.
Yeah.
I'm curious about it because it has this really cool, hooky, catchy sort of, I don't know if that's a banjo exactly that's going on, but it's, you know, it's, it has a musical hook going on. And then you have a pretty serious lyric there. I mean, at least a bittersweet lyric.
For sure.
I think the combination, the juxtaposition of them and then combining them creates a really great result. But when I first listened to it, I was like, well, this is like, hey, we're all skipping through the park, and then this is a pretty tough lyric. So how did you come up with that, BJ?
Colin DeMeo, he was the guitar player on that record. I was writing the song, and I had the chords, but he said he'd been sitting on this guitar lick for like 5 years, and he's like, I've never found anything I can put it into. And I was like, well, what key is it in? And he told me, and you know, I moved the capo up, and so I was like, just put it at the front of the song. Let's see what happens. And that and it's such a happy sounding guitar part,
right?
And it's become like, you know, the crowd, like as soon as we start that song, they don't have to hear anything else but that, and they know exactly what song it is,
right?
And then the drums, Kevin McLean played drums on that, and he absolutely crushed it. Like, he does this weird kind of syncopated thing, and it's not straightforward drums at all. It's like hand claps, and there was a lot of overlaying, like, foot stomps and hand claps and tambourines, and, like, to get this kind of really big, like, junkyard-sounding drum. And then the lyric is like this retrospective, like really bummer of a song, talking about like how I'd never lived up to anybody's expectations. And then it takes a twist at the end and it becomes a little bit more optimistic. And it says, you know, who's to say what the losing side of 25 is? Who's to define happiness? Like, I get to wake up every morning doing something that I'm absolutely in love with. Maybe I'm the winner here. Maybe I'm on the right track to doing it the right way. Who's to say what the right way is? And that song, when we recorded it, I was like, okay, this is great. Like, it was like a cathartic song for me to prove to myself. You know, I wrote it about, you know, my parents judging me for playing music. But then once we started playing it, I started realizing how it was affecting people and realizing that I wasn't the only person in my late 20s who had no idea what they were going to do with their life, right? No idea how rent was getting paid next month. And as we started playing, it became one of these songs off the record. And if you'd have told me before we released that record that was going to be like the hit, you know, I'm using that word extremely loosely, but if that was going to be the hit, I would have told you were crazy. I was like, it doesn't have any stereotypical parts to being a hit. You know, it's got this weird guitar part, it's got this weird drum part, but people relate to the lyrics. People relate to, you know what, I just graduated college and it took me 6 years and I have zero idea what an English degree is going to do.
Right.
You know, that guy knows what I'm talking about. And and it's fun to watch people at the shows, right? Like, it hits them.
Is it still a staple in your...
Every single night.
Every single night.
Every single... Right. Wolves and... I'm glad you picked two of the big ones off of those records. Because those are two songs. Since that record came out, I don't think I've been able to go a night without playing those two songs.
They all ask me how I'm doing. I just smile and realize that although it was kind to me, my youth is all behind me. Now I'm on the losing side. The losing side of 25.
I have one more song on Wolves that I'd like to ask you about.
Yeah.
And it's The Man I'm Supposed to Be.
Yeah.
And I have two specific questions. One is the career choices that you say, I'm not this guy. How did you, were those random, or did you have some thoughts about like where the differences between those different careers were? You know?
I started the song with the first lyric, I'll never be a sailor, conquering the open sea. That ain't the man I'm supposed to be. And then I realized, okay, well, this song could take that just naming off things that I'm not going to be. And then I didn't have anything for the second one. And then I wrote the line, which I think is my favorite line out of that song. It's, I'll never be a boxer. You know, I've got the heart, but no technique.
Yeah.
And I think that's just such a great way of saying, like, I'm a fighter, but I could never do it for money, right? You know? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, it was about trying to find other stuff that fit the mold and kind of And realistically, I narrowed it down to like three or four different occupations. But then, like, you know, acrobat, trapeze. Yeah. I was like, not too many people were talking about that in Americana songs.
Right.
I was like, let's throw a circus reference into it. But the way that song got started was, my wife used to give me a hard time about not writing love songs. She's like, you don't ever write love songs. Like, do I have to worry about anything? And I was like, I don't like love songs. Love songs, I'm not good at them. The Beatles wrote them all, and I'm not going to write any more of them. I will pale in comparison. But sad songs make me extremely happy. Like, it's what I listen to when I'm driving. It's what I listen to feel good. You know, I love really sad, depressing, slow songs. They light me up.
Yeah.
And so she was like, well, you know, I told her, I was like, I'll write a love song. And my wife was a bartender as well back then. And so she went to work one night, and I sat down and told myself, like, you're going to write a love song. You're going to write a love song. So I wrote it, and it's like in this, like, it's got this, all these minor chords in it. And she came home, and I was so excited. I was like, I waited up to like 3 a.m. I was stoked. She walked in, and I was like, babe, I wrote a love song. She's like, no, you didn't. I was like, yeah, I did. We sat down, I played it for her, and she just looked at me. She said, that's the most depressing love song I've ever heard in my entire life. But it's one of the, that's another one. You know, it's, I get probably tagged at least during wedding season, at least 20 times. Uh-huh. Somebody, it was what they walked down the aisle to, it was their first dance, or it was something that, you know, it still absolutely blows my mind that things that I make up in my living room late at night are mean that much to people. Like, to use, you know, you get to pick a couple songs on your special day, you know, and to have that be one of them in the canon of songs that relate to love, considering I don't have many. You know, it's a true testament to how important that song is for me. And we play that one a lot. That's one of those songs that, like, whenever we, you know, we do the full 90-minute set, I give myself three slow burners to throw into a set. You know, that's what I've learned can keep. Three, after three, you lose the drunk people, you know. But if three, if you spread them out properly, you know, you can still retain a crowd that way. And my wife still loves that song, and every night I get to play it. It's fun to watch, you know, I don't ever get to watch anybody slow dance to my songs, but you'll see the drunk start, you know, waltzing.
I have one other question about that. The musicality in the line, is it, no one ever called me a good man? Is that what it is?
Nobody ever called me a good man.
Nobody ever called me a good, and I love this. Nobody ever called me a good, huge space.
Yeah,
man.
Yeah.
Once again, intentional or.
I've learned that you need, if you feel good about a line, if you think a line's a good line, space is the greatest thing to emphasize how good a line it is.
Mm-hmm.
As songwriters, you know, we're cocky about certain lines. Like, when you know that feeling where you play a song for somebody and they've never heard it before, you put a little bit of extra sauce on the lines that you know are you know, you know,
extra sauce.
You know, right. you gotta let them know, like,
gonna break out my DJ Barnum sauce here.
You know the extra sauce that you put on the good lines.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, that's one of those lines, and that was intentional. Is when it comes to playing songs, I really believe that vocal delivery is one of the few things that you can control and make sound different than somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And I love experimenting with cadence and with space. I love writing songs to rhythm. I love writing these things that if somebody else tried to sing it the first time, they couldn't. That's the goal, is to, if somebody tried to cover this for the first time, they would have trouble with it. And if I've done that, then it's a vocal keeper.
Nobody's ever called me a good man, and that's all right by me. Just as long as you call me your man, that's the only man I ever want to be.
Mm-hmm.
I want to talk about touring, BJ.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it appears that you make the most out of your calendar when it comes to touring.
Against my wife's wishes, yes. We are road dogs, I think is the word for what we do. We have never been shy. I knew early on, my mom always said, I don't have the jawline for country music. So I knew that I was not going to get the big fancy.
Let's write that one down.
I wasn't going to get the big record contract with the big country music label. I knew that if I was going to earn anything, I had to do just that. I had to earn it. I had to go out and play shows in front of absolutely zero people until those zero people turned into 10, then 20, then 40, then 100. And so I told the boys early on, we started this thing up in 2006. I said, it's not going to be easy. My goal is to play 300 shows every year. And that's what we're going to do. And so the first couple years, we only got to about 250. And by shows, that is a very, very loose word for the gigs that we were playing. We were playing some of the crappiest bars and listening rooms in the country. We weren't making any money. We were going into debt. It was just a bad thing. But then we started seeing certain songs were affecting people. And you know, we'd go back to Louisville, and instead of 10 people, there'd be 15 or 20. And it'd be the same 10 people that brought somebody else. And we started realizing, as long as we're putting on a show every night and believing in the songs, we should keep doing it. And it took probably 4 or 5 years of just financial ruin until it started to not be financial ruin. And then, you know, 2000, there was a app called Bands in Town that charts what bands come to town. And every year they do a tally of who the hardest working band in the country is based off how many shows you played. And in 2011, we won the hardest working band in the world. We played 306 shows that year.
That is impressive.
And so the only thing the next year to do would be, okay, you know,
More shows.
So we set a record that year. We did 308. That's the most the band's ever done. The following year, we did 302. And then since then, we've been on a slow decline because luckily the shows that, you know, we figured out we could, as time went on, we could make more in 250 shows than we did in 300. And then we could make more in 200 shows than 250. And this year, I am proud to say in 2019, I'll play 82 shows. It'll be the first time I've dipped below 100 in 15 years. And, you know, everybody's got houses, everybody's married, everybody's got, you know, I got a kid. And I say it with pride the same way I said 308 back in 2012. Working hard has allowed me to take a couple more days off every year and focus on what's important to me.
So I read on your story that you have some kind of ratio or you're working on a ratio where the time that you spend on the road, you're going to keep the same amount of time at home.
Is that
the plan?
It's working pretty good. We'll do like 3 weeks on and then take 3 weeks off, and then do a week on, take a week off. You know, for this year, it's, you know, we'll take 6 weeks off and then hit it again. And it's been refreshing because you're letting these markets rest. You know, you're not oversaturating anywhere. You're only taking the gigs that really matter. They're the good gigs, you know. As much fun as it is to play Midland on a Tuesday night, I don't want to play Midland on a Tuesday night. You know, so it's getting to,
he's talking about Midland, Tennessee.
That's there. Exactly, yeah, what I'm talking about. Why would I ever say anything disgraceful about the state of Texas? But it's one of those things where we used to not be able to pick and choose. We used to be like, okay, like, and to this day, we still, if we go out for 3 weeks, we take one day a week off. We're doing 6 shows a week. And some weeks, if it's good enough shows, we'll do 7 a week, 10 in a row. So
how's that work with your voice,
man? It's a muscle, and I'm also a runner. When I got sober almost 5 years ago, and as soon as I got sober, I started realizing I had a lot of extra energy, so I started running, and the voice is much like your legs. You know, if you hadn't run in years and you go out for your first run, it kills you. But after about a month of running every day, your body, surprising enough, gets used to getting put through that torture every day, and it kind of expects that torture. My voice is the same way. I've been lucky. I say that, I'm gonna throw it out tonight, but I go really hard for about 2 hours every night, and I give it all she's got, and then I rest it all day. And then every day when I, sound check's always horrible. I sound like Tom Waits gargling gravel, you know. It's but then, you know, come showtime, after a couple glasses of tea, you know, a couple vocal warm-ups, it's back to fighting shape.
a whiskey on the rocks, an Adderall, a whiskey on the rocks, an Adderall. We're no different than the neon lights. We turn us on, we stay up all night. We do what we can, we put up a fight. We burn too long, we flicker and die. With nights like these that the drugs don't work.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll return to our interview with American Aquarium right after this. At Americana Podcast, it is our goal to define and expand on the genre of Americana music. With our help from our friend and music connoisseur, Will Vogt, this is Will's Pick. Is Americana music inherently American? Probably not, especially if you're listening to the music of Daniel Norgren and his record Wu Dang. These songs invoke John Lennon's solo records mixed with the sonically crude but beautiful sounds of the Basement Tapes. On Wu Dang, Norgren has created his own version of Americana that is stunning in its beauty and simplicity. His influences are obvious: Chicago blues, Motown, Southern R&B, but the resulting musical stew is way better than the sum of all these electric parts. Although intrigued by several cuts on the album, Will's pick is Let Love Run the Game, a song that was recorded in a 19th century farmhouse in northern Sweden, but takes listeners back to the basement of that famous pink house in upstate New York. And now back to our interview with American Aquarium.
So you got a scholarship to UC State, UNC State, right? Is this what?
NC State University.
NC State.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I'd say that's a typo. Okay, you got a scholarship to NC State.
We can't say UNC.
No, we don't say that.
NC State, yeah.
NC State, you got a scholarship to NC State. And it seems like when you first started in school, you simultaneously started a band. Is that, did I have that right?
For sure. I was from, Texas is a beautiful place just because music is so ingrained in people at an early age, especially live music. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Reidsville, North Carolina. We did not have a music venue. We did not have... If you played in a bar, you played covers. You didn't play original music. If you played original music, it was like your creepy uncle that played an original song at a campfire, and you're like, oh, God, that's horrific. Like, can we leave now? And then the nearest town to us was Greensboro, North Carolina.
Uh-huh.
And Greensboro didn't really have a lot of small music venues. Right. We had, like, the Coliseum and stuff. But up until I was 18 years old, I thought you either were like an amateur guitar player that played on your porch, or you were Tim McGraw. Like, there was no middle ground. There was no, I didn't know of independent bands. I didn't know of, original bands that were out there like hustling. And so when I went to college, I got introduced to the concept of indie rock, like bands that just said, the world be damned. We're going to pack up the van this summer and we're going to go play the country in front of nobody. I didn't know that existed. And so I was going to school for political science and history. I was going to be a lawyer. And so political science and history lasted about 2 semesters until I learned G, D, and C. And then I started going to open mics and playing absolutely horrific songs, like bad songs. Like, just, I never was one of those guys that learned covers, because I learned guitar just to facilitate me writing songs. I didn't really care about learning other people's songs. They already wrote those songs. I wanted to write my own songs. And it's, I equate it to like a cabinet maker. You got to start making really, really shitty cabinets before you can be a good cabinet maker. The only problem is a cabinet maker now who's been making for 15 years will never show you his first set of cabinets. But you can go on iTunes right now and buy my first set of cabinets for 99 cents. that's the only problem with what we do, is like, you get to go back and see how bad the song started and get to see where it moves to. But around 18, 19, I started writing really horrific folk songs.
And this is when you were at...
In college.
Okay.
And I made it about halfway through my junior year, and then I got offered to go on tour. And by tour, again, I'm using that word extremely light. I got offered like 8 shows up the East Coast, but it meant I had to miss class. And so I skipped class for 8 days and went out and I played New York. I played Boston. I played Atlanta. I played Nashville. Horrible shows. Nobody came, but I got bit by the bug. There was something about getting up in front of people, you know, 1,000 miles from home, playing songs that I wrote in my bedroom. And even if it was just one drunk guy lying to me at the end of the night about how good it was, there was somebody listening. And I got bit by that. And then I went and I started seeing time in class go down and me sitting in my room just writing songs and listening to, you know, Dylan records and Guy Clark records and Townes Van Zandt records. And until I started learning how songs worked and learning how, like, oh, I was just using cliche things. These people are actually saying interesting things in an interesting way that nobody else has said them before. I needed to try to do that.
Right. The Rolling Stones got their name from a Muddy Waters song. Radiohead got their name from a Talking Heads song. And Panic at the Disco got theirs from a song by the Smiths.
Yeah.
And you got American Aquarium from a Wilco song.
A Wilco song,
How
yeah.
did that spark your imagination?
Yankee Hotel Foxtrot came out my senior year in high school. And I remember going and picking up that record and having my mind blown. Because all I'd known of Wilco, like, I was a big Uncle Tupelo fan. Mm-hmm. And they were very much rooted in American roots music. It was like punk rock kids playing the Carter Family. It was amazing stuff. And so then when Sunvolt and Wilco branched off, I followed both of them. And Trace by Sunvolt is one of my favorite records of all time. Mm-hmm. But Wilco was the band that, like, really spoke. That AM record really did a lot for me. But being there was really great as well. And Summer Tea started getting into this kind of, you know, atmospheric noise rock mixed with songwriting. And then I remember I went to Turtles Music in Greensboro, North Carolina, the day that Yankee Hotel came out. And I just remember having my mind blown. I was like, it's funny that we're doing a podcast about Americana, because that was the day that I learned you didn't just have to have mandolins and acoustic guitar to be an Americana band.
Uh-huh.
You could, it's funny you mentioned Radiohead right before that. It's like, they were like the Radiohead in the Midwest. They were doing this weird sequence drum stuff, and they were doing this, it was just noise and this kind of really abstract way of writing songs, but I fell in love with it. Uh-huh. So when I went and I started a band, you know, we were trying to figure out, you know, that whole, the promoter's like, okay, well, what do we put up on the sign? And it's like, American Aquarium. And, you know, and we did it.
Uh-huh.
And sure enough, it was one of those things where after you put it on a record, after you put your name on the record, there's no changing it. You know, you got to live with it. And so to this day, it's, you know, a lot of people are like, y'all don't sound anything like Wilco. I'm like, well, that was never the intention.
Right.
They were just a big influence on me playing music.
Right.
And so to this day, it's been fun because I got to do a Rolling Stone did a big tribute to Anodyne. It celebrated, I think, its 30-year anniversary this past year. And I got to do an interview, and it was like me and Patterson Hood and all these luminaries that I grew up listening to. And it was all because, you know, my band's name was American Aquarium, and it ripped off a Wilco song, you know.
So I'm gonna hit the streets tonight, make my way towards the neon lights, and order a drink and a downtown dive till I forget my name. If I make it out alive, I'll call, you know I will. If I can just survive one more night in Jacksonville.
So one of the breakout hits from the early American Aquarium years is I Hope He Breaks Your Heart.
Yeah.
Can you give us some history on that particular song?
Oh, that is a visceral, visceral breakup song.
Uh-huh.
That is a punch you in the mouth. That's a blessing and a curse song, and I'll explain that. I wrote it when I was 21 years old, and the story behind it is funny because we were at a show. It was a girl I dated all through high school. We were engaged. We were about 2 months away from our wedding. She left me for somebody. You know, girls leave all the time. Guys leave all the time. It's life. But then we had a show in Raleigh at the Lincoln Theater, and she showed up to the show with the guy. And they stood front row. and we're just necking the whole night. And
thank you very much.
And I was just like, oh wow, this is going to be an interesting show. And the boys were like, don't say anything. And I was like, I was a little intoxicated. So I went back and just started scribbling down words on a piece of paper. And like, what are you doing? I was like, I'm writing a song. And like, what are you going to do with it? I was like, I'm going to sing it. And they're like, when? And I was like, tonight. So I got up there and I played a show straight faced. I didn't even acknowledge them. And the only people that knew about the reckoning that was coming was the guy standing behind me. The band is just like, oh God, he's going to cut loose here in a second. And everybody else is just like, wow, BJ's like really matured. Like he's got his head on straight. Like I'm really surprised he's taking the high road on this. So we get off stage for the encore and we come back on. I tell the band, I'm like, stay off stage. It's me. And I get on stage and I just light into this girl. And I'm just like, screw you, screw him. I hope nothing ever works out. I hope your future's terrible. I hope you have 20 kids, blah, blah. And then I played it for him. And I thought that would be, okay, good. That's the last time I ever have to play this song. It was cathartic. For the first time in my life, I'd put words on paper and got an emotion out. And whew, that felt great. I'd never have to do that again, thank God. But then somebody videoed it and put it up on the internet and YouTube. And then every show we kept going to, people started requesting it. And so like the band just learned like a loose bar band version of it. And then that started going around. And it was probably 4 or 5 years of playing that just in bars before we decided to put it on a record. And we made a record with Chris Stamey in Chapel Hill. We were sitting there and we had like 13 songs. And Stamey was like, do you have just like a big old rock and roll song? Just a big like sing along. And I was like, no, like these are the songs for the record. And the boys were like, what about that one we play every night that everybody loves? And I was like, I'm not recording that. Like it's not, it doesn't represent like my songwriting. Like I want thoughtful songs and at least something that rhymes. And so I played it for him, and sure enough, he's like, that's what needs to be on this record. And so we recorded it, and literally, to this day, every single night, I play it, and it's a big sing-along, and everybody, you know, there's always that one guy whose girl just left him, and he's at the front, and he's had a little bit too much to drink, and his friends are trying to hold him back, and he's just like, no, this is my time. Screw you, Cindy. This is for you. And And the reason I play it every night is because I know where those people have been. And I know that feeling, I know that emotion, and I know how good it feels to get it out.
A good one. So in 2017 you split ways with the longtime version of American Aquarium.
Yeah.
And you built another band. I have two questions that pertain to that. One is, why didn't you go solo under BJ Martin?
That would have been the smart move, I think. You know, I think I've watched enough VH1 documentaries to learn that that's when you go solo. when everything goes south, just put your name on it. The reason I kept the name, that band that quit in 2017, they had all been in my band for 8 years, but none of them were original members. Up until that point, I'd had 36 members in the band. They were just the last eight that decided to stick around for a while. I've never made a record with the same exact band on any record. So I decided that, you know, the one constant through all those records was me and my songs. And my wife sat me down and we talked about it. And I told her, I was like, as long as I'm willing to play these songs every night, I'm willing to play them under American Aquarium. Mm-hmm. The day that I stop wanting to do that is the day that I go solo. Is the day I can put out more solo records and just play all the canon of songs that I've compiled over the last 2 decades.
So 36 members?
Now we're up to 42 now.
Oh, so you're over the amount of members in Spinal Tap.
Oh, I've got... there will be a documentary made one day. You know, the thing is, I have to tell myself, I can't... The one thing I tell bands that lose members or break up is you can't take it personally. people aren't going to be at the same spot you are forever. It's like the root of a tree. You all planted, you all start off the same way, but eventually you start branching out. And then you look up and 8 years later, you're a lot further away from each other than when you started, whether it be the music you're into, what you want to do with your life, where you are in life, what your goals, what your aspirations are. And so I had to tell myself that I got a good feeling that I'll always be able to find five or six guys that want to travel around the country and play music.
So on this next one, I got another question here. This is a follow-up question. In your story, it says that this time around, you decided to hire professional musicians.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's it. And so when you say that, you're talking about people that you've seen or played or people have told you about, and you just went, I know that you do this all the time. I want you to come over to American Aquarium.
Yeah, that wasn't a knock at the previous guys. It was just, when I say professional, everybody that had been in the band up until this version of the band, I went to school with them. They were friends of friends. They were owner-operators. They were people that had a drum set, had a bass kit, a bass cab. This is the first time I went out, and they all lived in Raleigh. That was the big thing. This band, I went out and kind of just cherry-picked a band. I was really lucky. I found a drummer that kind of talked me into putting together another band. He said, what if I put together a band for you? So he got me. My drummer was from Lubbock. My bass player was from Stephenville. My guitar player is from Austin. My steel player was from Nashville. My B3 player is from Atlanta. So it was the first time in my career where I was at a point where I was like, sure, we can just fly everybody into wherever the tour starts. And right. It used to be we all had to be in Raleigh because I couldn't afford to get you somewhere.
Right.
We had to start that tour in Raleigh no matter what. And so I went out and kind of cherry-picked guys. And all of these guys have been playing music for, 10 or 15, just as long as I have. And that's what I consider professional musicians.
So you're liking this?
I love it.
Yeah.
It's great. It gives me the room where once somebody doesn't want to be here anymore, they can just come to me and there's no bridges burned. It's like, hey, man, I was here for 2 years. I got to focus on something else. It's like, cool, man.
While we're talking about the change in band members here, I want to ask you about when we were younger men.
Yeah.
Right? And my specific question there is, when I listened to the song, this may just be me, but I felt like each verse and chorus, almost you kind of picture a different person, or are you thinking the same person every time? It feels like here's this guy that did this and this guy that did that.
Believe it or not, that's to the five guys
that
left. That was to the whole band that left in 2017. Okay. That was because at first it was like any breakup. It was there was animosity. I was angry, and then I was like, oh no, what do I do? There was sadness. There was so many different emotions. But I feel like that song was the first time I was able to kind of hover over the situation and write from it from a not an angry point of view.
Right.
Just I understand what happened. Like, right. I hope that one day we can look back on this positively.
Uh-huh.
That was my only goal in writing that song. And to be completely honest with you, I don't even think three or four of those guys have even heard it.
Really?
I think we're still that much of a rift between us. But hopefully one day they hear it and understand that, the sentiment is real and that they, I realize, those guys got two sober years out of me, but they also had to put up with 6 years of me being a belligerent asshole. And that's something I can be open and honest about. I was a terrible human being. I'm still a shitty person. I just don't have an excuse now.
but we're talking with BJ Byrne. Belligerent asshole, waiter, bartender, road warrior, singer, songwriter, band leader of the band American Aquarium.
I'm quoting you on that.
Yeah.
When I think about that summer, I still hear the sound. Petty on the radio, I won't back down. I called you a brother, but you were closer than my kin. And it kills me knowing you may never pass my way again. But I hope that every now and then you look back fondly on the days when we were younger men.
Uh, Can I talk about writing here?
Of course.
Moving on, we would like to talk. I'd like to talk about writing. Your current writing routine.
I've got actually developed a routine, which is just waking up in the morning. I've found that I'm most fruitful in the morning. Uh-huh. I don't touch social media. I don't touch computers. I don't touch TV. I wake up. I make breakfast for me, my wife, my kid. I make a pot of coffee. I eat breakfast. The wife and kid go outside and play, and I go out on my porch for about an hour and a half every morning and just sit there with a guitar and wait for something to come. I'm not a spiritual person. I'm not a religious person. The only thing that will ever even be close to a spiritual experience for me is songwriting. I believe that that is something otherworldly. I believe that none of us, I don't believe I've written any of these songs. I believe that I was given these songs. I believe that, you know, every now and then you can reach up and grab something. And, you know, I think the best of us learn how to grab it quicker and realize when it's coming. Everybody I've talked to has these situations where, you know, you have these moments of, man, I wish I could have remembered what I wrote down. When I was sitting in the car, I had this great idea for something. That was just the muse trying to give you something, and you just didn't take it. So that's why, like, I travel with a notepad, I travel with a pen, I travel with voice recorders, and anytime I can come up with ideas, and most of them come between 8 and 10 o'clock in the morning. Hmm. And I've just learned that. And it's like any hunter, you know, you know when to set the traps, you know where to look, and I've gotten a lot better over the years at just being ready, having that pen, having a guitar there, so that when that little magical entryway opens up into that other world, I'm able to, you only get to stick your hand up there for a second and pull something out. You know, I've gotten pretty good at timing that, where I can usually get something if I sit down and focus at it. But, you know, everything starts off as a folk song. Before I bring it to the boys, everything starts off as these kind of finger-pick folk songs. Uh-huh. And the boys are the ones that add the muscle, they add the meat, I bring these very skeletal versions of things. And they're the ones that really kind of toughen the songs up and make them these kind of what people are going to call anthems or sing-alongs. Because if it was just my solo shows, I travel and do solo shows. It's just me telling a lot of stories and playing a lot of really sad folk songs. Right. The boys just speed them up to where you can't tell they're that sad.
So I want to talk about Things Change. Did it in Tulsa.
Did it in Tulsa?
Yeah.
Oklahoma.
Yeah, right. So did you ever go to the Dust Bowl bowling alley in Tulsa?
I did not go to the Dust Bowl.
Did you go to Kane's Ballroom?
I did go to Kane's.
Did you play at Kane's Ballroom?
I've played Kane's a bunch.
Yeah.
That's one of those magical places.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
When you walk in and you look up on the wall and Hank Sr. staring at you, you're like, okay, this is hallowed ground,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
It's there's very few rooms in this country where I still get intimidated to play, and that's, and we do that, we do Kane's at least once or twice a year, and we've done the last three or four New Year's Eve there.
Ah,
and
nice.
It never loses its luster.
Uh-huh.
Every time I walk into that room, it's just, you take a deep breath and you have to realize, like, oh wow, this is like a, you have to think that room, most rock clubs last 10 years. Uh-huh. If they're lucky.
Right.
20 years, you're historic at that point. 20 years of being a rock club in the same place, you're an institution in whatever town you're in. But imagine a place that has been around since popular music started and has seen every genre of popular music and every superstar of that genre when they started coming up through there. Like, those floors have seen literally everybody since Hank Sr. Any kind of music, hip-hop, rock music, punk music, like folk music, singer-songwriters, like big old rock and roll bands have all played Kane's Ballroom. Mm-hmm. Like, there's not many places in the country that can brag about that, that can say that. I think that speaks to the room. I think that speaks to the majestic quality. Like, because, you know, most people, if you tell them, like, man, I'm really excited about being in Tulsa, they're like, are we talking about the same place? But then you walk in Kane's Ballroom and you understand the what people are talking about.
And you work with John Fulbright on this record?
Yeah. one of my favorite songwriters.
Yeah?
Absolutely brilliant human being.
Uh-huh.
Most of us have to work at being talented. Most of us have to work at being good at what we do. That kid was born.
Mm-hmm.
And the way he does it is so effortless, which just makes me mad. You know, because
I want to break his fingers.
Because, you know, when I get up there and play, you know, I have to think about it and I have to try and I have to put forth effort. I think that kid just gets up there and he just opens his mouth and he's just this vessel of just rock. and he's good at it. He's really good at it. He's got this rawness that isn't. It's perfect. He's one of my favorite songwriters. And when I see him, there's not many songwriters that push me emotionally to tears. And I've seen John 6 or 7 times, and he does it every single time. There's these moments in his shows that just I'm in awe.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the power of music.
And he also worked with one of my favorites, Byron Burline. Yeah, that's killer. He's a killer. I've been a fan for a long. A bluegrass fan, so he goes way back, and also he's an LA session player and all that.
Yeah. He's not like a lot of people like just give him the bluegrass credit. Like when you're playing with the Birds and the Rolling Stones, like you've earned your rock credit too.
I think that kid,
you know, I've had the joy of playing a couple shows with him, and then when he sat in on this record, it was just, you know, when you have, I'm going to call him a master of what he does.
Right.
When you have a master come in and just, you know, put it down, it's pretty amazing.
And then John Moreland sang on the
record. Yeah.
How's that?
He's a buddy of mine. I remember seeing him in a little bar in Tulsa called the Mercury Lounge.
Uh-huh.
And 10 people there, nobody cared. And I remember it was like one of those movies where like star-crossed lovers cross eyes across the room. That's what his music did. It was like this loud bar, everything just slowed down, and I just focused on like, why is no one listening to the words this man is speaking?
Mm-hmm.
He's just transcendent is the only thing I can describe watching John Moreland play. And he's been a dear friend for almost a decade now. So it's I consider myself very lucky that he would sing on a record. Like I said, my career has been extremely lucky, just having friends that volunteered their time and talent. Like that record, we didn't talk about it, but the record before Wolves, Bird Flick or Die, Jason Isbell produced that record in Muscle Shoals, Alabama.
Right.
And this is before Jason was Jason.
Right.
This is back when he was just the guy from the Drive-By Truckers.
Right.
You know.
Right.
So it's my entire career has been littered with just being extremely lucky to have very talented friends that loan me some talent every now and then.
That's nice.
Yeah.
Loaning some talent.
Yeah, they make things sound.
Somebody would loan me some talent. We're going to move on now. We're going to get to the part where we like to talk about Americana music. And so how would you define Americana?
Man,
there's no right answer.
It's such
BJ.
A hard definition. It is. Non-mainstream music based in the roots. I always joke that it's anything with an acoustic guitar you don't hear on the radio.
that covers it.
Which is a pretty easy way of covering it.
Yeah.
If you have a guitar, a mandolin, or a fiddle, and you're not on the radio, you are Americana.
Yeah.
It's so, like I said, Wilco, I think, is an Americana band. But then again, like a band like Mumford & Sons would be considered an Americana band. And then you have the Turnpike Troubadours, who are an Americana band. And, you know, you have a band like us that, realistically, we're just a rock and roll band with a pedal steel guitar, but we're an Americana band.
Right. So you consider yourself Americana.
I hate using the word, but it's you look at that, you know, the conference they do every year and see what they're pulling from. It's all over the board. Like, there's punk bands that are playing that because it's based in songwriting and the lead singer plays an acoustic guitar.
Right.
So I will stand by my fact that if it has an acoustic guitar and you can't hear it on the radio, it is Americana.
Who are three artists that you would consider Americana?
I would consider John Moreland.
Okay.
I would consider an Americana artist, right. John Fulbright,
right.
And Jason Isbell, three we just talked about.
All right.
And I think those folks are pushing it. Right now, though, Brandi Carlile's new record, she's doing unreal things for the genre.
Uh-huh.
I think Gillian and David do a really great job at preserving kind of that's what we're talking about, the history of roots music. You go to see that, just two people, two voices, a guitar and a condenser microphone, it'll change your life. Like, that's what I think, that's the good stuff.
We hold up in those four walls as the world outside passed us by. When the morning's embrace
shed a light on your face I saw leaving in your eyes. Like a freight train it hits me that you're good and gone. Like a minor chord in a sad country song, I find myself sitting all alone the whole night through. So here I am in Richmond again, slow dancing with the shadows of you.
We're beginning our lightning round now.
Heck yeah.
By the way. All right. So this is an either or thing right here. Ready?
Okay.
Okay. Hot dogs or hamburgers?
Hamburgers.
Fishing or hunting?
Fishing.
Mozart or Beethoven?
Beethoven.
Hendrix or Clapton?
Clapton.
The four-string bass or the six-string bass?
Four-string.
Who would you like to share the stage with, living or dead?
Bruce Springsteen.
Ah, nice. College football or pro football?
College football.
We knew you were going to say that.
College. I'm literally wearing an NC State football jersey right now.
Yeah. Topo Chico or LaCroix?
Topo, all day.
There you go. Donuts or beignets?
Donuts.
Okay.
Home of Krispy Kreme.
I know. Brisket or pulled pork?
Oh.
He's on the fence of this one.
As a North Carolina boy, pulled pork is the definitive. But when I first came to Texas, I have never tasted anything like brisket.
Ah, this is where the grilling comes in.
This is the hardest question you've asked me, or the hardest question. Like, you can ask me to define Americana music, and I think that's easier than pick. Because you're talking about something that is so deep-rooted in my soul. Pulled pork is as North Carolina as it comes. But there is something so – it feels like a dirty, dark – just so my parents don't disown me, I'm going to say pulled pork.
Yeah.
I'm going to say pulled pork.
All right. The movie Taxi Driver or the movie Drive?
Oh, Taxi Driver.
Beatles or Stones?
Stones.
Analog or digital?
Analog.
Reverb or tremolo?
Reverb.
Turnaround or modulation?
Turnaround.
Allman Brothers or Avett Brothers?
Avett's.
Ah.
Come on, North Carolina.
Yeah, there we go. Meet and greet or stepping on a Lego?
Meet and greet. Like that.
Here's a guy that likes a meet and greet. All right. Yeah. Well, you already told us. You're out there.
I fully enjoy those.
Yeah. Florida Georgia line or line in the sand?
Line in the sand.
Okay. There's one last thing that we're going to talk about. And here's what we are here at Americana Podcast. We are trying to find a better name. We feel like it's just a shame that they take a beautiful instrument that's an organ and makes so many beautiful sounds and they call it the B3. We're trying to find another name for the B3. Do you just anything?
It's such a definitive part of our sound too. We travel with a full B3 and Leslie cabinet. Yeah, it's such a militaristic term. It's just like this, like, letter and a number for of the model of whatever it is. But
I never got it.
It's so much, you know. It reminds me of church. That's exactly what it's spiritual. It's some kind of spiritual instrument.
The spiritual instrument.
Yeah, it's a spiritual instrument.
All right, we have been talking to B.J. Barham with American Aquarium. My name is Robert Earl Keen, and we're listening to Americana Podcast, the 51st state. Thank you so much, BJ.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, man.
At this time, we would like to thank our host, Robert Earl Keen, John Selman at Whitewater Amphitheater, Charles Ray, and our guest, B.J. Barham. Americana Podcast is brought to you by Keen Productions. Edited and produced by Claire Rose. Mastered by Pat Mansky, with original music by Kim Warner. Until next time, let the music play.